Welcome to Insight at Noon, with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Food is center stage this week, from staples like turkey and all the fixings to other unique dishes that have become family traditions. Meals during the holidays often come with history and nostalgia. Ahead on Insight, we're bringing you a CAP Radio special, where staff take us for a trip down memory lane about the recipes and meals that feel like home. We'll learn about liti choka, a traditional dish from the state of Bihar in India. We'll taste a family salsa and sope recipe from Michoacan, Mexico, travel to the Yucatan for some salbutes, and learn how to make Ukrainian borscht, a rich, hearty soup full of earthy flavors. Finally, we got to end with something sweet, and what better than homemade Italian biscotti passed down through generations. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We have a special show in store for you today. With the holidays in full swing, food is a centerpiece when it comes to getting together for some quality time. And often what we make or eat has a story to it and is part of a family tradition. That nostalgia can be warm and powerful. So we're going to take a trip down memory lane. I sat down with my friends and colleagues at CAP Radio about the meals and recipes that feel like home. We're starting off with Sacramento education reporter Srishti Prabha, who opens up about their family trips to India and the special significance of liti choka, a traditional dish prepared over an open flame from the state of Bihar. Srishti explains that there's nothing truly like it in Northern California, and that's what makes it extra special. Well, Srishti, as always, nice to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Vicky.
All right. So the assignment was, is there a meal or a recipe that reminds you of home? And that can be kind of a loaded question. It can also, I think it's an intimate question, and that's why we're having this, because it can be really special. So where does that land for you?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Having an assignment is always fun. And so I came prepared slightly. I guess like my growing up, one of the things that we used to do during Christmas time or during the summer was go to India. That's the time you have the break. Everyone can kind of go. I mean, it's a little expensive, but I used...
Where in India would you go?
So my family is from, a lot of them are in Delhi, but then my mom's family is still in Bhagalpur, which is in Bihar. Bihar is on the east side of India. So it's kind of closer to Nepal. So that region, northeast. And the thing that I think of when I think of a meal is like a very traditional Bihari meal. And it's called liti choka. Liti choka is, you won't find it anywhere else, and it is literally just a specialty there. It is made of this thing called sattu, which is a type of gram flour grain, and it's like a condensed ball. And then they fire it up in an actual fire. So I think that's why it's like so much fun to do it during the winter, because it's cold. It's kind of like a campfire, except for it's in the city. And they put the liti in the fire. And with that, you have chokhas. And chokhas are just things that are side dishes that are made on also fire usually. So you'll have eggplant, you'll have onions, you'll have tomatoes, but all different kinds of chokhas. So they have different names, obviously, in Hindi, but you eat them and it's cold outside, but you're near a flame and it's extremely dense. So you're, you know, very full after eating it. It was a meal that a lot of farmers used to eat for sustenance, because actually Bihar was like a lot of farmers and farmland. So that's the meal that I think of when I think of specialty foods during the holiday season.
That sounds delicious. It sounds also, it could be fragrant as well. I mean, I would imagine, I know for me, like some smells can make me nostalgic. Do you get that too with that meal?
Of course. Yeah. I think Indian food generally has a spice smell, like all the different spices. I really smell it when I go home. You know, growing up, people used to tell me I smell like spices, but I didn't really understand it. But it's just this kind of scent that like stagnates in the home because we're cooking all the time with all these spices. So any spices kind of remind me of Indian food, like the traditional, like the garam masala and the dhania and the jeera. And, you know, that's like coriander and cumin, like those spices all together, you know, just always reminds me of Indian food. But the jokha smell is like fire. So like fire roasted tomatoes, fire roasted eggplant, like that smell, I don't even think I can replicate it really in the U.S.
Oh, so it must feel so good when you travel to India and actually get to take it in and not only eat it, but it usually starts with the smell, with the scent of it.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I'm so annoying that even in the summer, if I go in the summer, I ask my mama, which is my uncle, to make me litti chokha in the summer, even though it's hot. And it's really hot in Bihar. So that's how addicted I am to the smell and the taste of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also that meal, it has such special significance to you, too. And that's what I love about food and talking about food. You have a story of immigration. When we did a storytelling show a year or two ago, you talked about your migration story, you know? And so I also think, you know, my parents are immigrants as well. Going back to the country where you were born, where your parents are from, what have you, I just think it's even more special when you get to eat food like that as well. It could, because you stay connected to your culture, even if it's been a generation between it.
Yeah, and I'm sure your mom, like, if you have conversations with your mom about how she made the meal, there's probably no real recipe. The ingredients might not even be found in the U.S., so they're using substitute ingredients. I mean, that's one thing for sattu. That's not, like, a thing that you can actually find properly in the U.S. Like, you can, but it doesn't have that fresh taste. It doesn't have the same. A lot of the vegetables aren't the same. So my mom has had to, you know, adapt a lot of those recipes. I'm curious if that's kind of similar for your parents.
Yeah, and I think about that more for my grandparents and my abuelos, because even though my parents were born in different countries, my mom was born in England, my dad was born in Guadalajara, Mexico, they came as children. So I kind of call myself like generation and a half, like I'm not first generation.
Yeah.
And I do think there's a lot of people like that as well. So I think being a little more removed from it, as you say, like you can't get the exact ingredients when you're living here. And there is some assimilation that takes place. And that can vary from one household to the next. But it seems like you continue to retain, you know, the culture that even if it is difficult to retain here, you still find ways to incorporate it.
Well, I definitely think that's a product of being a recent immigrant, right? I think a lot of these things, my parents moved here as adults, right? So their life was spent mostly in India. Maybe now it might be half-half, but, you know, they still feel very connected to India. And I think they've really imposed that on me in a good way. I feel very connected to my culture, and food is like such a common way to be connected to your culture. So the food is actually the thing that ties us back to India generally. You know, that's the meal I ate every day was Indian food growing up. I never had the classic American food. I was eating roti and dal and a sabzi, which is roti's like the, you know, the tortilla type thing. And then sabzi is a vegetable and dal is lentils, right? So that's what I ate growing up every day, basically. And then we would spice it up with some other stuff like a pizza or, you know, even like getting Thai food or Chinese food or any of that. That was like extra supplemental. And I think that a lot of immigrants kind of grow up that way. I'm thinking that that might be similar to you because we talked about food for Thanksgiving last time, I believe, and how it wasn't the traditional Thanksgiving meal. It was a mix of all these different things. And I think that still holds true for me even now, is like we'll do a mix of all these different things.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing. I mean, you incorporate your lived experiences and even those of your ancestors, too. And that's a wonderful thing. I'm mixed race. A lot of my friends are mixed race or maybe they're first generation. And so it's really interesting and fun to do something like a holiday party or a Thanksgiving, especially as journalists, we move around a lot. And then you invite your friends over, your chosen family. And yeah, it could look a lot different than a traditional Thanksgiving feast, but in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's what the purpose of these holidays is food, right? People really get excited about Thanksgiving food and Christmas foods. And I think that food can look different in a melting pot society. It's not one note. I mean, yeah, we actually do make a turkey now, but we still have Indian food at the table at times, too. So I think that's kind of the essence of holiday season.
When it comes to Indian food here, that when you go to a restaurant or you go look around to see if there's something that kind of feels like home. I mean, India obviously is a huge country, and sometimes things can get, cuisine can get reduced when you're in the United States. How is it when you kind of just go out on your own and see what's out there?
I think that's a great question. Obviously, India is multi-note, you know, and there are so many states within the country that are all so, so different. So I don't even think the diversity of the Indian cuisine is really replicable. In Sacramento, I haven't really seen it, but I am from the Bay Area, where you do have a lot more of that as a growing, not only a need, but a love. Like, there are food trucks, and you're going to find, you know, you're going to find pani puri, and you're going to find maybe litti chokha somewhere. You know, these are things that are starting to become a thing. But I'm not going to lie to you, I generally don't look for Indian food because I can just have my mom make it.
Yeah. Well, because I was going to ask, when you do actually stumble on one, do you get excited? Like, oh, hey, that's here.
I want to. I think Indian restaurants still pander to the American palate, which makes it hard for me. Like, butter chicken's not something that I generally crave. That's not, just for historical purposes, also not Indian. It's a British cuisine that was created for British people who could not, their palate could not take Indian food. So, yeah, like, I think in the Bay Area, because there's such a large Indian and South Asian population, you see more diversity and you actually see, like, South Asians going to these places. But out here, I haven't really found anything yet. Yeah.
Finally, going back to you taking us, really helping us visualize why you love the meal that you were sharing with us. It's clear that there are a lot of memories that are tied to it. You know, food is so much more than what you put in your mouth and what you see on a plate. If you can just expand a little bit more on why it's so special to you.
Maybe some things that are special are things that you can't get frequently.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why I'm maybe so connected to it, because it's a thing I don't get regularly and it's only made on special occasions. My mom does make litti chokha out here, but it can't have the same essence to it because you can't have an open flame in your home. It just doesn't have that feel. And so I think because I can't get it frequently, I crave it more often than not. And I think that's why.
Srishti, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
I'm hungry. That is Sacramento education reporter Srishti Prabha talking with us about the special significance of litti chokha, a traditional dish prepared over an open flame from the state of Bihar in India. Up next, you're going to stay hungry. We'll head to Mexico for salsa and sopes, visit the Yucatan for salbutes, and learn how to make Ukrainian borscht. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today is a special show where CAP Radio staff open up about the meals and recipes that feel like home. Sarita Ochoa, Alice Merkley, and Victoria Hagel may be unfamiliar names to you, but they have been an integral part to CAP Radio for many years, even decades. And they're coming out from behind the scenes to share some recipes you can try at home. Sarita shares her family's salsa and sope recipe from Michoacan, Mexico. Alice takes us to the Yucatan and introduces us to salbutes, a puffed deep-fried tortilla with toppings like avocado, meat, and pickled red onions. And Victoria opens up about her time in the once Soviet Union and learning how to make Ukrainian borscht, a rich, hearty soup full of earthy flavors. Well, Victoria, Sarita, and Alice, thanks for making the trip down the hallway.
You're Yay. Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right, Sarita, I want to start with you because you're the director of First Impressions. You are the first person we see and the last person we see. You're the best person for that job here at CAP Radio, and you've been doing it for a long time. So I brought up that I wanted to do a show about food because food is connected to us in so many ways. And you jumped in and you wanted to share. So how big of a role does food play in your family?
Food plays a big role in my family, especially having kids and a large family. Oh, yeah, it plays a big role. I mean, who doesn't like to eat?
I know. I mean, we're friends on Facebook, and I see the parties that you throw. You're also known for making your salsas and your cupcakes as well. So where did your love for cooking come from? Did it come from past generations?
Absolutely. It came from my mama. So I, you know, when I was young, I would always watch her cook in the kitchen. She would actually make me go into the kitchen to see how she made her food. And that's how I learned. And of course, I passed it down to my kids. And so now they know how to cook the dishes I know.
Why is it important to pass it down from one generation to the next?
I think it's very important. I think that way the food tradition keeps going and going. I think it's good for them to know where we come from and how this food is made. So
yeah, and yeah. Food has a story. You know, and it can be a good story. It can be a difficult story. But that's the beauty about food, is that it can tell a story. What is your story about the meal or the recipe that you want to share with us?
Well, the recipe that I want to share with everyone is our Mexican sopes. You know, this is my mom actually showed me how to make these sopes, and they are just so wonderful, so tasty. I mean, as soon as you have one, you're going to continue coming back for more.
For those who haven't had a sope before, describe a sope, because there's corn isn't a lot of meals for Mexican food. I mean, obviously you have corn tortillas. Sopes are a little thicker. They're kind of like a little bowl where you can put some really yummy food in it, whether it's carnitas or carne asada or what you're going to share with us.
Absolutely. This dish that we make, it's made out of corn. So we make it into a dough. Of course, we add water to it and then roll them up to balls. And then after that, then you flatten them down like tortillas. You put them on the skillet and make sure that they're browned in each side. And then after that, you make it into a shell, like into a little boat. Then you deep fry it. And then after you deep fry it, then you have your choices of toppings. So the bottom is, we always put the sour cream on the bottom because it tends to, if we put it on top, it tends to fall over. So it goes on the bottom, then we put beans, then we put the choice of meat, then we put cheese, then cilantro, onions, and my favorite salsa. So I'm really good at making an awesome salsa, yep, which we could talk about.
Let's get right into it, because no salsa is like the other. There are so many different ways to make salsa. Obviously, you know, I mean, I think people just naturally go to like red or green. There's obviously different ones in between. There's a whole spectrum. What is your salsa and why are you so proud of it?
I love this salsa because my kids can't get enough. My kids choose the red salsa, which is very simple and easy. It's tomatoes, tomatillos, jalapenos, dried chile peppers, garlic, cilantro, and a little bit of salt. And all you do is just roast those. Of course, you save the cilantro for the end because it's fresh. But you roast it, then you throw it into a blender, and then you add the salt, and bam, there it is.
It sounds simple, right? You think about those ingredients, you're like, hey, I can do that. But there's a way to do it, and there's a consistency that you're looking for, and you roast yours before you blend them. That you don't necessarily have to do that. Everyone does something differently. What tips do you have for someone who maybe they're listening to this and they're like, hey, you know what? I'm going to make my own salsa. Like, that sounds easy to do. And it is pretty straightforward, but there's a trial and error with any thing that you do in a kitchen. What advice do you have for someone who's giving it a first go?
Well, make sure you roast everything. I recommend roasting than boiling.
Me too.
And roasting, and don't, as soon as you're done roasting, don't take the black chard, leave that on. Absolutely, because that's what gives your salsa the flavor, that smoky flavor. Oh, yeah, that's my recommendation on that for sure.
When it comes to the dough for the sope, also can sound straightforward. I mean, you add some water to it, but you're also looking for a consistency. And so I think about like when making tamales, right? Like there's a consistency that you're looking for. It can be kind of tricky if you're doing it the first time, especially if you're doing it alone and you don't have like an abuela or a tia kind of showing you how to do it. What advice do you have for someone who wants to do it, make it from scratch for the first time?
Well, they can. The only thing, what I recommend is starting slowly. You know, don't add too much of the ingredients right off the top. Start slowly, start tasting it, seeing if the consistency is there. And if not, then just keep adding that flour until you get the right texture, then you go for it. Then that's when you start making your dish.
When you're making the sopes, because it was passed down from one generation to the next, do you feel closer to your family when you're doing it?
I do. I really do. It makes me feel like I'm at home. You know, these sopes are from, my mom learned in Mexico. It's a little pueblito called Chavinda, Michoacán, in Mexico. And this is where she learned. And, you know, and I'm just moving it forward, so...
Okay, who's tried Sarita sopes? Has anyone tried
yes,
them?
Yes. Yeah.
You have? Victoria, how were they?
They were absolutely wonderful. And I don't know what I liked more, the taste or the smell around it, or Sarita's just, you know, being so in it, in the process. But also, I love Sarita salsa. And I can tell you that I tried to make it the way Sarita did it. No, she is not revealing the most important ingredient and secret. It's probably something like love or coming, you know, ancestors' memory coming into it. I did all of this, charred it, did all of this. Maybe also I didn't have Sarita's pen.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes.
Well, I would expect nothing less from Sarita. And you're right, yeah. Victoria. The most important ingredient is love. Mm-hmm. You know, the love that you put into your food. So, Victoria, that brings me to you. You are sharing a meal and a recipe with us. Tell us about food. We all have different journeys and life experiences that surrounds food. What's yours?
Oh, like a person, like a human being, I need food to eat. And my experiences with food here are kind of similar to everybody else. But as you know, I had a first life in Soviet Union. I am a product of Soviet Union. So my experience is very different because I didn't learn from my mom how to cook, because she didn't learn from her mom how to cook, because she was born in 1940s. And the stories around food that she's telling me is how she found a piece of soap and thought it's a piece of bread. And the best food she had was a bread in the milk. You know, they just soaked in milk. So when I grew up, I actually grew up in the most beautiful time in the Soviet Union. It was a very stable time. And I always think about my growing up as a very happy place. But in our social life, family did not play as much of a role. And we learn everything from the community. For example, I learned how to cook borscht, which I'm going to talk today about, at school. That's my first experience. And kind of like in other gatherings, I would say, oh, that's how you do the fish. Oh, this is what smells so good. Oh, this is how you do galupci. So I kind of learned about food and how to cook on my own, not exactly, among the people. I think that my best feedback on my cooking was from my ex-mother-in-law. And I'm actually grateful for that, because she gave me a couple of tricks that I'm going to reveal today about borscht that was, you know, pretty important, which, of course, I didn't take.
But she does get some kudos. I mean, what drew you to food? You mentioned that it wasn't passed down in your family, but you even tried Sarita's salsa recipe. And at an early point in your life, you were interested in not only eating people's good food, but kind of learning how they actually did it. Why do you like cooking?
My appetite. I was very, you know, chunky girl, and I had a very good appetite. So I liked sweets, and I made my first cake because my mom didn't do this.
Which she's really good at.
Yeah, by the way, my first cake was for my mom's 40th birthday, and she was upset that I put 40 on the top. So anyway, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that rule, not disclosing the age, right?
Yeah, I was like 12 years old, I think, mm-hmm. and I was just like, so what? 40 years old? Oh, my God, I do remember this. Mm.
So borscht has history behind it, too. Food also is tied to history. What do you want people to know about borscht before you dive into how to make it?
When I was preparing for today's beautiful event, I actually went online and learned something that I didn't know about borscht before, that in 2022, when the Russian invasion happened, UNESCO put culture of Ukrainian borscht cooking in the list of intangible cultural heritage in need of urgent safeguarding. So I guess the world was kind of concerned that Russia can do something to the Ukrainian borscht. And one more thing why the borscht is very special to me, when I came here, everybody would, you know, I talk to people and I will tell, I am Ukrainian, and everybody will say something, oh, I know, I had a Ukrainian housekeeper and something like this. But when I talked about, they would say, so Russian borscht, and I, all my life, like here, all my life here, just like, no, borscht is Ukrainian. And I'm very grateful to UNESCO to recognize that borscht is Ukrainian, which is not completely accurate because borscht is in a lot of countries in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
We can find it in Poland and in Ukraine and Belarus and in Russia as well.
Yeah. So how do you make it?
Actually, my probably the best borscht I started making were here. And I think it's because of demand. You know, my family just like, oh, you're going to make borscht. And the borscht has so many recipes, and it is really, you cannot write the recipe. You need to keep it in your head. And the success of borscht starts with two things, broth and the right beets. You cannot put any other beets. So those two, and of course, borscht can be vegetarian and can be with chicken, but the real borscht is usually have broth from bones and meat, and it should be pork and beef. So that's how it starts. And of course, a lot of beet vegetables that nobody else is, you know, using, like celery root or parsnip. Or at my time, when I was, you know, during the Soviet Union, we had salt, we had pepper, we have dill, and we had parsley. That's about it.
And the dish you made just recently for us, the soup, was it? Or what?
Well,
the soup you just made a few months ago for us.
Well, it was always borscht. Yeah.
That was delicious.
It was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was. Yeah. I had two bowls.
Yeah, we made a couple of, Sarita and I had a history of making soups for CAP Radio. So
that's wonderful. And I mean, what I'm hearing from you, it seems that it could be kind of time intensive, right? Because, I mean, if you're talking about a good broth, I mean, that takes patience, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Yeah, absolutely. And usually you make a huge pot. You made a, you know, like, I don't know how many gallons this is, but you don't make borscht for one, which is kind of interesting. That means that you do need to feed the family.
That goes the same for us.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I think about pozole, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. Yeah. There are a lot of similarities between Mexican and Ukrainian cultures. For example, sour cream. Mm. It's always
used.
And then we use a lot of chicken.
We do too.
We use a lot of pork.
And beef. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We combine beef and pork in our culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't use beets, though.
No, not beets.
No beets. No. We'll leave the beets to you.
Because the beets were, you know, that northern thing.
Yeah. Okay, Alice, you are up and you're going to be sharing a meal and a recipe. But I'd love to just start with a little bit of your family history and your background.
Sure. My dad came to the States in the Brosetta program. And after many trips, my mom decided either you take us with you or you no longer can go and work there. So I'm from Yucatan, and we lived in the city of Mérida, which is the capital, and it's close to Cancun. So my dad came over, and we came over in 1966. But the most important thing when we came over from Mexico is that my mom wanted to hold new traditions, and she was adamant about making traditional food like Thanksgiving meals. So her first time her first crack at making it was actually the turkey, and it didn't cook in time. We didn't realize, or she didn't realize, that you don't put a frozen turkey in the oven.
You have to let it defrost for a couple days.
So over the years, she mastered it, and that has brought our family together. And actually, food. We come from a long line of great cooks. My grandmother, Fausta, my great-grandmother, Anita, and my mother. And our new generation, I love to cook. My sister and brothers love to cook. And now we're passing it on to our kids. And I have a nephew, Danny, and a niece, Michelle, who continue cooking the traditional dishes. And I do, too, but not all the recipes, because there's a lot.
That's wonderful. And you know what? I think a lot of people, that turkey story is going to resonate with a lot of people. It can be tricky. And there's hard learning lessons in the kitchen. That's how you get good at it. You got to, especially if you're giving it a go for the first time. What is the meal or the recipe that you want to share with us?
So I'd like to share salbutes, which is a traditional dish from Yucatan. And it consists of it's kind of like a tortilla or a tostada. So we prepare it with cornmeal masa and a little bit of flour to give it a different consistency. And then we press it with a little tortilla smasher or
a press.
A press. Yeah. Thank you. A press. And it's deep fried. So the story behind this meal and why it's important in our family is that we celebrate traditional Thanksgiving dinner, but the next day, the doors are always open for anyone to come to the house, and my mom would make this traditional food from Yucatan. So I'll explain how we make
it. Please do.
So my mom will take the leftover bones and start with a broth. So there's two pieces of meals that kind of go together. And so she'll take the leftover bones and some giblets, and she'll make a broth. So for the actual salbutes, we have the dough, masa, and then we have beans that my mom made a day before or 2 days before Thanksgiving. And she takes the beans and she blends it. So it's kind of like a puree. And then she just cooks it for several hours, slow cooks it. So then the masa is pressed and cooked in the oil. Then we use the beans, and the other ingredients are lettuce and tomatoes, avocado, jalapeno. And something that a lot of people have now learned about is taking red onions, slicing them, and adding lemon, and they turn pink.
Yes.
So that's how it's layered. So we put the deep-fried tostada almost, and then the beans, the lettuce, the tomato, and the onions. And if you are game to eat jalapenos, you would garnish it with that.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Sounds yummy.
It sounds so good. And it's also, I think, really common to repurpose food after a big feast, whether it be Thanksgiving or what have you. And that is a perfect example of repurposing it, but with your own family history and your own family spin on it.
Exactly.
What do you do with the broth?
So the broth, after it's cooked, so something simple. We like to use the small shells pasta, and she puts it in, or my mom used to put it in a broth, and then add some garlic, and then cook it. And a little bit of tomato and onions. We fry that, and then we add the broth, and then we add the shells, and that's it.
Is it second? Is it separate thing?
It's a separate thing, yes. It's just a broth, yeah. Okay. And that's what, so we'll have
so it's
our
like
broth.
A soup.
Yes, yeah, like a soup. And then we'll have our salbutes. And that's a meal. Oh, and then we can drink it with horchata.
Yeah.
Or Coke, because in Mexico, Coke is dominant versus Pepsi in the United States.
It is.
Your family eats well.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Not only on Thanksgiving, but the days after Thanksgiving,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. We like to celebrate, again, combining both cultures together.
Yeah.
Well, this was such a treat, and I love that all three of you seem to already talk about a lot of food and find some commonalities, because there are a lot of things that we share in common food-wise and cuisine-wise from our own cultures, and once you just got to start talking about it and start sharing how you make it. And then you realize, hey, like I would have never thought that there would be some similarities between Ukrainian food and Mexican food. But here we go. Here we are.
Here we are.
Thank you all for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It was a treat. That is Sarita Ochoa, Alice Merkley, and Victoria Hagel sharing their family recipes. We learned about salsa and sopes from Michoacan, Mexico, salbutes from the Yucatan, and Ukrainian borscht. If you'd like to try any of these meals, we put together a list of family recipes. You can find it online at our Insight page at capradio.org. Still ahead, we got to end with something sweet, right? And what better than homemade Italian biscotti passed down through generations? You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're rounding the corner on a holiday special where food is center stage and Cap Radio staff are opening up about the meals and the recipes that feel like home. We've learned about lirichoka, a traditional dish from the state of Bihar in India. We got a taste of a family salsa and sope recipe from Michoacan, Mexico, traveled to the Yucatan for some salbutes, and learned how to make Ukrainian borscht. Now we're going to end with something sweet. Paul Ferrari is pretty new to the Cap Radio family, and he opened up about reviving a longtime Italian tradition, homemade biscotti. Paul did some experimenting with his grandma's recipe and shares two versions, cranberry almond or chocolate toffee. Paul, thanks for making the time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, you volunteered for this. I imagine that food plays a big role in your family.
It does.
Tell us a little bit about your family.
My family mainly gravitated towards the Italian background, though I have multiple different ethnicities within me, but it's mainly Italian. And I remember growing up, it was my grandma and grandpa's on my dad's side of the family. Every family reunion, it would be raviolis, biscotti. It was always some sort of food, also, and the smells of the house. And at any time we got together, that's what it was always about.
Yeah, that sounds delicious, first of all, and all homemade, right?
Oh, my grandma was big into homemade, everything from scratch, crust from scratch, dough from scratch, nothing store-bought. And that I admire her for that. That was fantastic. So that takes a lot of time. I've tried to emulate that in many ways. It's like I just don't have that type. Like the raviolis, I can't emulate that simply because it takes way too much time. And with the recipes, they're a large batch. So they will make them for the year. So we have these big ravioli parties once a year, and it would be making them. It would take a week, and you make them, and it's for the entire year. You stock up and save. I just don't have a week to donate to that anymore, which is kind of sad, but it was a wonderful memory for me. So
I also think with that hindsight and doing it yourself, it gives you a deeper appreciation for everything that your grandmother did.
Oh, absolutely. And growing up as a kid, you just don't see that. You get older.
You enjoy it.
You do. Oh, of course. Absolutely. Though, yes, there was a time when I did not. And that's because I walked in the kitchen and saw some of the ingredients. And as a little kid, you go, oh, my gosh. Anyway, and ran out.
Yeah, it is a labor of love. Absolutely. Yeah. Which is why it's so special and carries on for generations. Was it easy for you to kind of hone in on a recipe that you wanted to share?
Yes. The reason the biscotti is what I honed in on was because it's something that I have adopted, able to do on my own, not with participation from any other family members. It is something that my dad likes. My wife loves it. And I feel good about continuing that part of the tradition, making it and handing it out for gifts.
That's a wonderful gift. I mean, I love dipping it in my coffee.
And that's what it was originally for. Now, I always make mochas, so it's not as great in that, but I absolutely, and the funny thing about it is the original recipe was actually an anise almond, large batch. Yep. The thing is, I'm not a big black licorice fan. So when I was a kid, I didn't enjoy it at all. And then they started adopting these different recipes on top of that. So the what came over from Italy was the anise almond. Mm-hmm. But what got adopted was the cranberry almond. And then
that was probably easier on your palate.
Oh, I loved it. and as well as the they made a chocolate toffee. And I've kind of modified that. So it called for semi-sweet and I went to dark chocolate.
So now that you're making biscotti, I would think you mentioned that. Was there a language barrier? Was it hard to find the recipe or to kind of go through it?
On the language side, it wasn't. It was just handwriting. So everything was written by hand. It was on these old index cards, and everybody wanted them in the family. So the things were photocopied repetitively. And the way they wrote it, it was, well, does this really mean teaspoon or does this mean tablespoon? What does this specifically mean? And the instructions on how to assemble everything and bake it varied per recipe, though when you start experimenting, it's like, it's actually kind of the same. So you adopt that as you go through it. And it's just like this is the way they were thinking it through when they're writing it out. But my grandma had everything memorized.
Of course.
Right? So she would just do it all the time and she made it. So when we were asking for these recipes, when it was handwritten and I got the photocopy of the photocopy of the photocopy, so as preparing to do this, I went and reviewed that. I forgot how hard it was to read the handwriting. And I had to really sit down and I typed it out on the computer. So I am thankful for this because it forced me to actually put it into digital format. It won't change. I'll remember it from this point forward because I forgot that I do have to sit, reread everything, make sure I understand it, and then, you know, start baking it.
Right. I also think there's probably a special piece to even getting a copy of a copy of a copy of handwriting from decades ago. My abuelo, grandfather on my dad's side, before he passed away, he gave me his old high school and college notebooks. Ooh. And just flipping through them and just seeing his pencil marks and his drawings. He loved math, so they were all math notebooks. Wow. And formulas and things like that. I have one of them tattooed on one of my arms. It just was so special because I go back to like a 17-year-old, 18-year-old abuelo before he became an abuelo or a father or anything like that. And it's, it really is just so special and invaluable. I would think you get that too, looking at the handwriting of your grandmother.
Yes. Well, and I just received an old copy in a DVD format of them making it. So apparently one of my cousins had filmed it videotaped it many years ago, probably in the early mid-90s. And they just sent me the DVD because they want me to transfer it, upgrade to digital and edit it. And yes, it just, you get rocketed back into time and memories. And I think, you know, that story you just shared and just if you get a chance to reconnect with your culture, reconnect with who your relatives were before you knew them even. I think that's just so cool to do. I just love that idea.
So what is, I mean, you already shared a great deal about the story behind the biscotti and the iterations that it's taken and also the challenges of actually, you know, getting it down on reading it legibly,
sure.
You know, because of, you know, time that happens. Mm-hmm. So how do you prepare it?
Well, I will commandeer the kitchen just because I have my eldest kid loves to cook. So when they're in the kitchen, it their process takes hours. So I make sure I mark it out saying I have no room. Everyone stay out of the kitchen so I can get to it because it will take time. It will, you know, I take up counter space. I take up table space, bringing out the ingredients, laying them out, dividing everything up, getting ready to sift all the dry ingredients, and then mix it with the mixing bowl with the wet ingredients. The dough itself, once the batter is made, it's very, very sticky. And so you got to constantly flour your hands to try to minimize the amount of stickiness to your hands. But it's very, very messy, very difficult. But it's fun to make. And then get the oven ready and then put it in. And my first time I made it, it was an interesting journey because I misinterpreted how you cut the loaves, the size of the loaves. Because it's supposed to be, as you can envision a biscotti, a nice, small, little, long cookie.
Yeah. Kind of like a finger.
Yeah. Mine was a little bit more like a loaf of bread.
A little extra.
It really was. It tasted wonderful. It really did, but it was much larger, and it wasn't as hard and crispy, even in a double-bake situation, to get it to that crispness, because I didn't account for how much the dough expanded. And at that time, that was my first go of it, and then I learned from that.
So you mentioned a double-bake. So mm-hmm. you double-bake biscotti.
Yes. Yes, you do. So what you would do is once you make the dough and you create the loaves, you put it in the oven on average 25, 30 minutes. It'll run about 325 or 350 degrees depending on which one you're making. It comes out. It just needs to be firm to the touch, even at the center. Let it cool a little bit. Then you cut it into the biscotti shapes, the actual cookie size. Stand it up on its end on a cookie sheet. Put it back in for another 15, 20 minutes until it gets nice, crispy, and hard. And that's what creates the hard crisp biscotti.
So if someone wants to give this a shot, I have only enjoyed biscotti. Mm-hmm. I have never made biscotti before. If someone is listening to this and they want to give it a shot, how skilled do you have to be as a baker to give this a go?
I don't think you really need to be that skilled. Just need to be patient. And I had learned over the years, you must read everything before you go into it, simply because don't assume, don't pretend, just read it. Make sure you're got all the ingredients. I mean, for me, I've never considered myself a baker or a cook. However, people tell me I do a good job when I do it. But from a skill set, I would always never consider myself anything more than a novice. But it is something that I enjoy doing. It takes a couple hours. Just take your time.
When you're making it, do you feel closer to your family?
Yeah, it does bring back memories. And it does the smells. So I do enjoy that.
Yeah. And I'm sure people enjoy when you give them away because, I mean, you can buy biscotti anywhere, but homemade, I mean, that takes it to a whole other level.
My dad is always like, so Christmas is coming. Huh? Yeah, I get it every year and I'd like to be able to do it more often. So I do need to start carving out more time because he does enjoy it. And, you know, I want to be able to enjoy the last, you know, because as he gets older and as all of our parents get older, enjoy the times you have left. And try to make those memories last as long as you can. And I like the fact that my kids connect with it.
Absolutely. You mentioned you have some competition in the kitchen with one of your children, right?
I do. But they are more of a cook with fish and shrimp, and I have an allergy to seafood. So I step out of that. But they have blossomed in ways that I couldn't even fathom or imagine when I go back 10 years ago.
Wow.
Because they were just a Kraft macaroni and cheese person, and that was it. It's all they would eat. Now they're doing all sorts of things with salmon, shrimp. It really boggles my mind. That's their breakfast. They'll get up in the morning and they'll put a chicken on the oven. They'll just.
Who says you need eggs?
They don't.
They don't.
They don't. It's just, I'm just really impressed. And I love it.
That's why I love talking about food, and especially with a family or a chosen family significance, because it just brings a smile to your face. And it's like a type of photo book in a way,
you know,
when you talk about food that's really special to you.
It doesn't matter what your culture, your background is. Food is related some way, somehow. So it's just a great way to reconnect back to those cultural paths and those memories.
Well, Paul, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate this. This was a lot of fun.
That is my CAP Radio colleague, Paul Ferrari, sharing his family biscotti recipe with two ways to prepare it, cranberry almond or chocolate toffee. If you'd like to try any of these dishes or all of them, we have a list of recipes shared on today's show. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Sarit Lashinsky and Jen Picard. Our digital producer is Chris Feltz. Our audio engineer is Tyler Webb. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great holiday. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here after the holiday.